It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
All right, and away we go. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, my friend Mike Ward.
How about it, Sean? How you doing today?
Well, you know, it's the end of another deer season. It's in the rear view now.
It's all over but the crying again, isn't it?
Right. Well, but it's, you know, it never stops for folks like us. I mean, a lot of people looking forward to turkey season. I'm still knee-deep in thinking about quail right now, so...
Yeah,
there's a lot to
do. It's always one season to another.
And by the way, we're not going to do it on, but we'll do it on probably next week's show too. Talking about the heads up here, March 1st, triggerfish back open too for gulf anglers. So there's a lot to talk about.
When it's 12-foot seas, that's the best time to open it up.
That's right. That's keeps us from catching our one triggerfish.
Isn't March the windiest month of the year?
What's the old thing that you say? It comes in like a lion, out like a lamb, or
comes
in like a hog and out like a dove or something. I don't know, something like that. So, hey, this is a real treat because it's a show I've wanted to do for a long time, and lucky to have Stephen Mitchell, who's the Upland Bird Coordinator for the state of Alabama, joining us on today's show to talk about quail and all things quail. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on.
Thank you guys for having me.
And Stephen, you come highly recommended, and when I was doing my research on you months ago and I saw that you worked, I got to start this off, at Tall Timbers, I said, there's a man I need to talk to. So, I mean, you talk about like the Harvard for all things upland and longleaf. Really, talk about that. Talk about your kind of history to where you are now working for the state.
Yeah, I went to Auburn University, graduated there. And as soon as I graduated, they shipped me off to started work for Auburn's wildlife unit there. And they shipped me off to South Georgia. And at the time, the Albany Quail Project was umbrellaed under Auburn University. And then later on, they made a transition to Tall Timbers. But basically, a lot of the same guys, all in quail management. It was a great time. Cut my teeth there on real quail management, and it was a great experience. And, you know, that's the quail hunting capital of the world, in my opinion. Great quail numbers, a lot of good quail management going on a lot of contiguous acres there.
Yeah, that's what I'm so interested in. We're going to delve into that as well, because when people think about other, you know, oh, well, they got plenty of quail in Texas, which is still debatable now with some of the things, or it's Oklahoma, this and that. But that doesn't look like where we live in Alabama. It sure looks a lot more like where we live in Alabama when you're in the Red Hills of Georgia.
Right. Right.
Yeah, so, you know, at least showing that it can be done. And I got to ask this and go back. So were you always interested in quail? I mean, if you look, I'm just asking, I'm not trying to pick a fight here, Stephen, but if you're going through and you're looking at wildlife to be associated with and what you're going to study and what you're going to do, the dang deer and turkey seem to be a little more popular out there anymore. I mean, why'd you go quail?
It was a job. I grew up as a deer and turkey hunter like most folks in Alabama. You know, that were born past 1970 or 80, and deer and turkey were my passions, and did a little bit of quail hunting, but most folks had already stopped having bird dogs and doing much quail hunting by the time I was, you know, old enough to go. So I did a little bit, but, you know, going through school, my mom said I had to go to college, so I found something I was interested in, and I went, and by the time I graduated looking for a job, I was actually blessed. I mean, not many jobs were out there in wildlife at the time, but I was actually blessed to hear about an opening with the Albany Quail Project and talk to some folks and got my foot in the door and went and got another education on quail.
Stephen, you said something earlier that really kind of hit me. When you were growing up and you said people were getting rid of the dogs while you were growing up, it just wasn't much quail. What happened?
Well, you know, land use changes over time. You know, habitat decreases. Since the 1960s, you know, quail populations declined, and that decline is all due to a loss of habitat. You know, the land use practices from, you know, probably the 1920s with tenant farming, sharecropping, small farms, all that's gone away. And that, you know, reduction in habitat, reduction in quail populations.
Yeah, I know, you know, I've got several really good friends that grew up hunting in the 60s and 70s for quail hunting, and it's kind of like deer hunting out in Kansas. Go knock on a door and somebody lets you go deer hunt their property. And it's the same way with quail. You just go knock on somebody's door and say, hey, can I hunt your farm? And they say, yeah. And they'd go get 6 or 8 or 10 coveys up in a day. But you just don't have that anymore.
That's right, and I've heard those stories, you know, getting into quail management and some quail hunting over the years. I've ran into a lot of people with that same story. You know, they would get up at home and be gone all day, and they could leave the front porch and find, you know, 10 or 12 coveys before lunch and, you know, be back home for lunch and then go again and do the same thing. Times changed. You know, it's a combination of things. Like I said, those early land use practices, farming methods were replaced by cleaner and more mechanized large farming practices that, you know, depended on more herbicides and insecticides, small fields wooden way, the weedy edges, those old brushy fence rows were cleaned up. And, you know, all that provided ideal quail habitat, but it all kind of disappeared, along with pastures, too. They've been developed into real cattle or hay production, planted in grasses like fescue that really have no wildlife value. Even our silvicultural practices changed over the years. You know, they produce thick, closed canopy forest now that sunlight can't get to the ground to produce any of the cover that quail need. And one of the main factors over the years has been a decrease or even just non-existent in most of those timber practices is, you know, no fire. Prescribed fire went away across all the landscape, really, and has created conditions too dense for permanent inhabitation by quail.
And I want to talk about that, too. There's so many. So you talk about prescribed fire, talk about these landscape changes. So it's interesting. Often when we're talking about wildlife species, you're talking about, man, back in whatever, pre-Columbian or whatever, back, go back 300 years, 400 years, 1,000 years, there were all these more of these critters. Do you have any way, or has there ever been any kind of, I don't know if you do through fossils or whatever, it seems like back what you're talking about, the 20s, 30s, 40s, we had a population of quail probably, I'm guessing, you correct me here, higher than we would have had when Columbus hit the New World.
I would say so. You know, from probably the 1920s until the real decreases or declines started being seen in the 80s. But those, no records really exist that give us an answer for those days before that. I mean, we know quail habitat existed because of the clearing, the farming, and the burning practices of Native Americans. Those practices,
right,
you know, they produced open lands and lightly stocked woodlands, but there are no records of actual quail numbers during that time period. But we do know that they were widely distributed and little utilized by Indians. A comparison to that time might be Stoddard's report from the 1920s.
You're talking about Herbert Stoddard
from
Tall Timbers fame. Okay.
Yes, sir. But his report from the 1920s of studying an unhunted quail population under natural conditions on about a 10,000-acre tract of virgin pine forest in Florida, that would have been the closest representation of much of the original piney woods of the southern coastal plain, you know, way back. And he determined the quail population there to be relatively abundant.
Okay.
About one bird or per 4 or 5 acres. So you could figure times earlier than that, there were quail there, probably in decent numbers in places.
Okay, so one per every 4 or 5 acres, and kind of giving people, you know, some bearing on this, a super managed property, right? Like some plantations in South Georgia, super managed, can do one per acre or two per acre, right? Versus one for four or five. So, I mean, with management, it's just kind of a weird thing because people always think about that. If everything was left alone, there'd be more critters. But it seems like with quail, it needs that human hand to bring those numbers up.
It does. It does. It's, you know, the quail are an early successional species, a product of early successional habitat, which doesn't mean an untouched, pristine meadow next to an old-growth forest. They thrive when the soil is disturbed and the succession set back in those forests.
Yeah, for Mike, so early successional, so what do you mean, the succession of what?
Plant communities.
So it taking it back to, I mean, that's because I think about fire, I think about disking. It's like we're not letting things get older, right? I mean, it's the brand new stuff that grows up.
Right, you're taking it back to the ground. Early successional habitat, that is early successional plant communities, and it's dominated by herbaceous vegetation, grasses, annual weeds, legumes, and that's interspersed with brushy cover, open stands of timber. It's a diverse mix of vegetation comprised of about a third forbs and legumes, a third grasses, and a third low woody species.
And we're going to find out what those species look like here at home and how to promote them when we return. Have a conversation with Stephen Mitchell, who's the Upland Bird Coordinator for the state of Alabama. We're talking quail. Yes, I love it. And I'm a throwback to those people from the 1960s and 70s. And heard too many stories growing up. Has me still interested in them today. All right, be right back. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. Our special guest, Stephen Mitchell, Upland Bird Coordinator for the state of Alabama, who has experienced what in today's world, I would argue, is the best of the best in quail hunting in the Southeast with his time in South Georgia. And you said Albany. I get corrected by it. What do they say? Albany or something like that? Stephen, what is it? Like,
it's Albany.
Albany. Albany.
Don't go down there and say Albany. You got to say Albany or they will kick you out.
Yeah, I got corrected by a guy one time. He's like, what are you talking about? That's in New York. Albany is in Georgia. I'm like, oh, okay.
That's so, right.
Different place. All right. And talking about, you know, quail, it's so interesting because, I mean, I know all of our wildlife species are a product of the management or lack thereof that we're doing on land. But it seems like if you had to rank them, right? Is quail like the, canary in the coal mine here for management?
Kind of. Yeah.
Is it the hardest? Let's say deer, turkey, rabbits, you know, there's squirrels, whatever, and quail. Which one takes the most work to manage habitat for?
It would be quail.
And there's, because we're going to get to this later, but just a nod of the hat to the idea of, well, if you don't have quail, just go buy you about 10,000 and turn them out on your place.
Yeah.
It doesn't work?
Kind of like turkeys.
No. It will not work.
Because, yeah. I mean, that's what people hear when they know I quail hunt. They say, well, why don't you, you know, and when they're hunting with me, they say, well, why don't you just go turn a bunch out? I said, well, I could turn them out and we could shoot them like tomorrow or the next day. But beyond that, y'all have shown in your research, Steve, it doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work. Pen-raised birds serve mainly two purposes, dog training and to have something to shoot at.
That's right. A novice like me, tell me why that wouldn't work. Because the logic would tell me, well, put them out, and they're alive and kicking right now. Why won't they be alive and kicking next month?
Well, you have to figure, wild quail will occupy good habitat in most cases. So releasing quail, pen-raised birds, where you don't have wild quail, you're putting those pen-raised birds into poor habitat to begin with and hoping they'll live in that unsuitable habitat. So they're going to fall to anything and everything from predation to a lack of food. And then they don't really produce. They might nest. I've seen it. But they don't have a learned response to really hatch that brood and help that brood to survive. They don't have that natural instinct to take them where they need to be or
It doesn't have mama taking it around and showing it what to do while it's growing up. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay.
And it seems like, and that's the strategy. I always like picture shrimp or pogies, you know, in the water down here in the Gulf, like quail in our woods, that they got to produce a bunch of little ones or try to have some make it. I mean, is that right? I mean, they don't, I mean, they're born to die, kind of.
Right. You're correct.
Yeah.
So we mentioned this. I won't go into this now. You mentioned predation. I want to come back to habitat. But the predation here, if you have, yeah, you're talking about release quail, but let's talk about wild quail. What kind of impact is predation? And if you had to pick your offenders here for quail predators, how would you rank those? Other than people.
Quail,
other than humans.
We'll start with adult quail. Through the year, you're going to lose around 80% of that population. Even on some of the well-managed places,
wow,
they lose about 80% annually of the fall population. And that can be attributed to hawks and, the ground mammals. But hawks are going to get their fair share. You can't do anything about hawks because they're federally protected. Owls also. The main ground predators or nest predators are going to be your raccoons, possums, skunks, even bobcats. So that's where you would need to look if you were going to start a trapping program to help your quail population.
And those are, I mean, similar to the people that if somebody's trapping to benefit turkey numbers, they're, in a way, if there are quail in the area, they're benefiting their quail.
Correct. That's right. Any ground nest and bird, I mean, taking out those nest predators, it's going to help them all.
Yeah, it's funny. I mentioned those two things. So we'll go through what are superstitions out there or what's real. I'd say it's a spurious correlation because certain things happen that let wild turkey numbers come back, but that happened kind of right around quail numbers falling. There are some folks I've sat on a porch with before, Stephen, well, one guy who told me, well, it's the wild turkeys. When the turkeys came in, they started eating the quail eggs and chicks. They were pretty sure because they didn't, yeah, it's a spurious correlation, but they saw turkey numbers come up and quail numbers go away, so they thought they were associated.
No, that's a myth. I mean, turkeys are opportunistic, so if you get a big old gobbler out there and he sees a quail brood, he might take one or two because after hatching, a quail is about the size of a bumblebee. So you can imagine those little jokers running around in the weeds out there. He might mistake one for a bug.
A furry grasshopper.
food is food to an animal.
And also to you and I, Mike.
That's right.
All right. So back to the beginning of this, and so what we can discuss some predators some more, and that's part of it. But it is something that, number one, you said, if you're going to release birds, if you don't already have birds and you're releasing birds, if you don't have the habitat, you don't have any birds, you're not going to hold any other birds. And so
right,
it's coming back, whether you're releasing a bird or trying to get wild stock, you got to have habitat. So what does that habitat look like? And we can kind of paint us that perfect, you know, picture, and then let's get into real world stuff. So the perfect picture, basal density, burn cycle, all that, and then what we might be able to get some success with.
Okay.
So perfect world. Yeah, you get to call the shot. Stephen Mitchell's saying, all right, I've got the hand of God right now, and I'm going to take this 4,000 acres and do it this way.
Yep.
Well, the main thing is disturbing some soil. And it all depends on the property and the existing habitat. But you need to create or improve the early successional habitat. If your timber stands are too thick, you need to thin so the sunlight can reach the ground. During thinning, you can also daylight the roadsides. That provides some early successional habitat along the roadsides and easily manageable. The brood habitat, it provides that also. And it also will help your road systems to stay
they
dry.
They get dry out.
You're saying widen the roads.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
You know,
20, 30 feet on each side of that road, take that timber out.
Yep.
And it'll help all the way around. And that you don't have to put as many interior openings if you the more the better, but you know that's an easy spot to create some more early successional and brood habitat.
But you're talking about when you're talking about though, getting it's too thickly stocked. What you're, once again, we're back in your perfect world. We're going to get into real world stuff, but in perfect world, maybe in, yeah, you can use it as basal density. But tell us what that means per acre. How many pine trees are on each acre in your perfect world?
You're getting down to a 40 acre basal area. That's really thin. You know, depending on the age of those trees, is, you know, you can't really.
Right, that's true.
Can't really say a tree per acre.
But we could see through it, right? Somebody's picturing it riding down the road.
You're picturing it. I mean, your nearest park.
Yeah.
With those big mature pines, that's what you're looking at. It's open. I mean, you can see all the way through it. You can see a dog run through there. It's basically bare ground with a few trees.
That's why I appreciate you doing that. We're establishing that as perfection, and then I want to get into the back in the trenches and talk about what we can actually do. But that's perfect. And then you talked about soil disturbance. Is that fire? Is that other mechanisms? What other than fire do you use?
Disking. You know, for folks that are starting out, if they can do it, invest in a tractor and a disc, and then put it to work. And we're talking fallow field management. If you have openings or don't have openings, create those openings and disc that ground up. It sets everything back, and you don't have to plant anything in most cases. That seed bank will have beneficial weeds in it that are going to sprout. And you can even do some strip disking through wherever you can, through the woods, through your pines. Some of that thinning, they're going to do a fourth row thinning or something like that. When those stumps rot, you can get in there and put that disc in the ground, and that's creating brood habitat. The fallow fields and those other strip discs, that's creating brood habitat, and you can let that stuff stand even the hunting season, and it's still going to attract some birds around, but hunting season falls about the time you want to set it back again on a year-to-year basis. You don't have to disc it all up. You can rotate some of it and leave it for cover and food through the winter, but that brood habitat is often the most lacking cover on any place I visit.
That's a good transition. Because I have about 100 questions for you on strip disking, but we'll get maybe that to another show. Let's talk about the habitats. So you mentioned brood habitat. Kind of break down the different habitats needed for quail, and you say brood habitat means what? Just what is a brood habitat?
A brood habitat is basically weeds. It's something that most landowners don't want to see, and they go to mowing and cleaning everything up. But during the springtime, that brood habitat is important.
And that is when broods we're talking about. So, mama, the chicks have hatched.
That's correct. That's correct. You know, we can break down quail cover into a few different things here. We can. There's nesting cover, there's brooding cover, there's loafing cover, escape cover. I mean, you know, still sum all that up with early successional habitat. The nesting cover, it consists of clumps of bunch grasses such as, you know, blue stems. A lot of people call it broom sedge or broom straw, wire grass, and many others. And in the spring and summer, you can, you know, they need that first thing, and it's usually not lacking. Nesting cover is usually not lacking.
Okay, so that's not a limit. So that's not, I mean, it's good to promote, but that's not the biggest worry. You think most places might have nesting cover?
Yes, most places I visit have nesting cover, and if they don't, that's a relatively easy fix.
Okay.
The brooding cover, you know, bobwhites are going to thrive in that open or thin forested areas, and as soon as that happens, you're going to get nesting cover pretty quick. Well, when that happens, you're also going to get the brooding cover for a while.
Why is it a bigger issue?
You have to disturb it. It has to be set back, especially if you're just using a burn to create that brooding cover.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to go away pretty quick, a couple of years. But that's why you depend on the fallow fields. Anything you can disc up, that's going to provide your brooding cover. It's going to attract insects. It's it does a couple. Brooding cover does a couple things. Those weeds, mainly ragweed. A lot of people, and ragweed is the best. I'll just go ahead and say it. A lot of people are going to sneeze just listening and hearing the word. But ragweed is the best. It'll provide an overhead cover to protect those chicks and let them feed. And usually at the ground level, it's open under there, so they can escape predators under there, and it protects them from sight overhead. And that ragweed also attracts a whole lot of insects. So that's mainly what a chick's going to feed on for, you know, the first 2 weeks and to a month of its life.
Y'all, just like turkeys, right? I mean, we talk about that with turkeys, how important insects are for them.
That's right.
So, okay, and ragweed, which, by the way, side note, right, ragweed, done test on it, it can have, like, what, 18% protein or something? So not bad for your deer either.
That's right.
Ragweed, somebody's got ragweed, been trying to fight it forever and get rid of it, but what do you do in a formula? And I want to get into this when we come back from the break, like on management areas or whatever. Like, is there a certain time we disc to get more? I play hell getting ragweed, you know, where we are. I mean, is there anything somebody could do to make ragweed come on more than another weed species?
Sometimes those seed banks are devoid or lacking in that seed. So you can buy ragweed. First thing you need to do is get your soil pH right, and it doesn't have to be perfect to grow ragweed. It can be around a 5, but get that soil pH taken care of, and if you still are not seeing the response, you can buy ragweed seed and plant it.
Although, by the way, just side note, I've looked at some of the mixes of native seeds. Mike laughs at me last year when I called up to buy a bunch of partridge peas, and I said, well, give me yeah, whatever you got. Give me a 50-pound bag,
yeah,
or something.
A couple hundred pounds, that stuff.
They
yeah,
said, well, you know, it's $9 a pound. I said, well, give me 3 pounds. Give me that. I'm not such a big talker anymore. We'll talk about this more when we come back. Our guest, Stephen Mitchell, Upland Bird Coordinator for the state of Alabama. We're talking quail right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, glad to have you here. And good to talk to Stephen Mitchell, Upland Bird Coordinator for the state of Alabama. We're talking quail, all things quail and habitat. I want to just finish a little bit here. We talked about nesting cover that you said that wasn't as big of an issue. Brooding cover, you talked about the overhead on that, Stephen. What is, I kind of know the answer to it, but I'm going to set it up. What does it look like underneath that overhead cover?
It's clean. It's almost bare ground. Those chicks can move freely, and even adult quail can move freely to forage and escape predators.
So, in this, we want dirt. We want exposed dirt.
Yes.
And so, sometimes people think, I'll hear people say, oh, that's good quail habitat. I'm looking at a thicket of grasses, and it's not, especially for broods.
That's right.
Well, coconut grass is one that definitely wouldn't want for... Well, you don't want it for quail. You don't want it
for anything,
or anything really. Yeah,
you want dirt underneath of this ragweed if you can get it. And you said ragweed's the star, but there are some other grasses that help, or are forbs that help.
Right. Well, basically anything if it doesn't form a mat, or get too thick at the ground level. There's all types of weeds that will provide the overhead cover, and attract insects, which is the main thing you're wanting. So it doesn't have to be ragweed. Partridge peas, they're also another good cover. Some thickets, you still want the thicket scattered out through your area. So, blackberry, those are good places that hide quail.
Yeah, I want to get to that, for the escape cover. But as we say on this line here, so if we're going to have that cover you're talking about in setback succession, I want to make sure we say this, is you don't set back succession by bush hogging it.
That's correct.
Because that's just still the same plants.
A lot of times you're promoting, you know, a pasture grass or a thick grass that's going to impede movement.
So fire or disking, and if we disk, when do we disk to make this happen?
Most times, it's soil and site dependent, but most areas I see, you're going to disk in the fall.
Okay.
And also, you know, on large areas that you have to hunt, that serves two purposes. You're going to be removing some habitat that you don't have to cover with that bird dog.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a great time to put a disc in the ground. And
just go through it. You're doing nothing else. You're disking it up and you're leaving it.
You're disking and leaving. And in the springtime, those plants are going to sprout up and create the brood cover we're talking about.
All right. Mike had a question during the news break I thought was interesting. I think I heard Stephen sigh at this one. But, Mike, what was the question?
Okay, my question is, we was talking about the quail, and we was talking about the release quail. They won't reproduce and everything. So let's just say I had 2,000 acres, and I want to have a quail plantation. I love quail hunting.
And you said you had a covey.
I have a covey, okay. And I might have two coveys on that 2,000 acres. What would I do to enhance that to get where I can start hunting? I don't want to wait 15 years for those two coveys of quail to reproduce enough for me to be able to hunt. So what could I do to have quail in 2, 3, 4, 5 years to start hunting? Is that a possibility?
It's a possibility. First off, you're going to have to make sure that you've done everything to that habitat first. And usually, if you've got a seed population of quail there, they're going to respond. There's also the possibility of a translocation project, which we've been involved with a couple with tall timbers here in Alabama on some private properties.
So what does that involve?
First off, you have to have at least 1,500 acres of contiguous property. It has to be high quality bobwhite habitat. You have to have, and we will do a population census on that property beforehand, but your property's quail population has to be less than one bird per 4 acres. You have to have a 3-year management plan, which incorporates, and that has to be in place and written up and followed strictly. But it has to incorporate the appropriate burning regime, fire frequency, scale, and season to ensure long-term quality habitat. You have to agree to a population monitoring plan prior to, during, and following the translocation.
It's like he's read this before.
I think he pulled a manual out. Yeah.
Wait, could somebody, if somebody didn't have 1,500 acres, but you had two people who had 750 that agreed to do it together, I mean, would they be able to do it, or it has to be one landowner?
We could probably do that with a couple of landowners, but that's something, you know, we would have to visit and talk about,
right,
because we don't have that, anything like that in place now.
But we're back to Mike's 2,000 acres. He's got the and he's worried about 15 years, but you just said, I mean, it seems like if you build it, they will come. Those quail, even though 80% die every year, they can, right? They can, I mean, those, we all see the population booms of quail in places where just year to year they,
right. And we have, you know, those seed coveys and populations throughout the state that are hanging on and hanging out just for the next clear cut, because you guys have probably seen it too, but where I'm from, a lot of timber company land is there, and they'll, you know, come and do a 300 or 400 acre clear cut every now and then, and that sets back that succession. And about the second year, a second growing season, conditions are pretty good for quail there. And you will start hearing some quail in the spring whistling around those areas. And, you know, fall hunting for deer or something, you go across that clear cut and you're liable to get scared by a covey flushing up in front of you.
So clear cutting in a limited fashion for I don't know how many years is valuable for quail.
Yes, it can be. And, you know, like I said, I've seen it, and we still see it. And, you know, those quail hang around there just, you know, that clear cut's eventually going to get reforested, and the conditions are going to eventually get worse as that timber grows and that overhead canopy closes, and all that early successional habitat just starts fading away. They'll hang on around somewhere waiting on the next clear cut to form.
So there you go, Mike. Yeah. You start clear cutting.
So there's nothing else. I mean, there's no introduction to any kind of quail that you can. You can't put any kind of quail out there that you can start multiplying from, like the release quails. I know that don't work good. There's got to be a few. If you released 1,000 quail out there, there's got to be a couple of them that might would survive, right? Maybe.
I've never seen it.
Never seen it. Okay, well, then that answers that question. A lot of people would be curious of that. Would any of them survive if you put 10,000 out there? Would you get any survival rate out of it? So you answered that question. You wouldn't. So you just got to have the habitat and hope to have a few coveys of quail, and they just multiply through time.
Right. And that's the thing. If you do the habitat management, quail will come.
Mm-hmm.
And they will multiply, and it doesn't take very long. I mean, if you, especially with the intensive management, you've thinned your timbered areas, you've put in fire breaks, you're starting a burning regime, and you want to do the burns. You don't want to burn tree line your whole property. You know, you want to burn in basically a checkerboard or a mosaic fashion.
Yes.
You know, and I'm talking the ideal burn unit size is around 40 acres for quail, maybe 50, however you can break that up. And the adjacency is important. You want that burned area to be next to unburned areas, so you don't take out all that cover. If you're doing that, you've got your brood habitat, you've got your fields established, you've daylighted roads, all that stuff. If you're doing that, you will have quail. And if you don't, that's when you contact me, and we will work on the translocation project. But I'm pretty confident if the habitat is there, you're going to have quail, and they're going to respond in a short amount of time.
Are we
awesome?
As you do this, I mean, obviously it's what you do for a living, so you got to believe in it, that we can turn this around. I mean, I don't know that we go back to 1930 or 40, but Can we come back from this? What is the reduction? Quail populations, I heard, what, 80 or 90% down since back then to now?
Yeah, it's hard to be exact, but yes, that's widely reported that we've had an 80% decline in quail numbers since the 1960s.
Wow. I mean, y'all imagine that was, you know, deer right now, what people be saying. You know, deer went one way and came back. And so can we turn this around? Maybe not a full response, but can this picture be better?
It can be better. I'm not sure we will ever be able to get back to those conditions that existed 60 or 70 years ago, because those, you know, landscape level changes, land use patterns, land use changes over that time period, it'll be hard to set those back. But we're working on it. But, you know, we'll... I'm not being negative here, because it can happen. We've got localized populations that are doing great.
Okay.
We've got private properties that have high quail numbers, but they also intensively manage those places, and they have the resources to do it.
Are places in, I know those fantastic numbers out of North Florida, South Georgia. Are people in Alabama on a given specific acreage being able to get close to that?
Yeah, we've got several places in Alabama that are. They have great quail populations, but they have the resources, and they're working hard at all that management, and it's year round.
Yeah. Let me ask this before we run the break too. Is we're talking about private lands, this and that, but what about a public land component? I'm thinking about most of the up and bird hunting I've done outside of Alabama. I've been on public land in Midwest and out west. Are y'all doing anything here? The things we're talking about, is that going on public land in Alabama? And are there conflicts with that, with like deer hunting and turkey hunting and all that?
Yeah, we are managing our public lands for quail. You know, we're the conflicts. I'm not sure you would call it conflicts, because in most cases, when you're managing for quail, you're benefiting deer and turkey.
Right.
The conflicts we might run into on public ground is trying to set seasons where, you know, people with guns hunting different species. Sometimes that's a conflict. So we have to manage that. And the only real conflict as far as habitat that might arise, you know, in upland hardwoods, on a lot of the intensively managed quail plantations, those hardwoods get removed to open up more ground for quail cover. And the deer and turkey are more dependent on those hardwoods than quail are.
All right. We're coming right back, and more of this conversation. We're talking to Stephen Mitchell, who is the upland bird coordinator for the state of Alabama. We're talking quail right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. And coming up, too, well, we'll talk about this in the next segment, a special addendum here, another show. We're going to get into how to get programs that can help you implement these things on your land. Nesting cover, brood cover, escape cover, we didn't even get to talk about.
Is that an app?
Is there an app for that? There might be. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, continuing our conversation with Stephen Mitchell, upland bird coordinator for the state of Alabama. A lot, we're just skimming the surface on so many things. Coming up, we'll have a special edition, another show coming up. We're going to get into this habitat side even more. Talk about that shortly. Yeah, we were talking about public land, Stephen, and what y'all are doing for quail management on public land. What are y'all doing, and kind of where are y'all doing it?
We have some form of public our management going on most of our public lands. I'm talking about wildlife management areas. Some areas have soil and forest conditions that are more conducive to quail management than others. But to give a list of what we have going on, we monitor quail population trends through call counts during spring and fall each year on 20 of our wildlife management areas and 3 special opportunity areas. The monitoring allows us to measure the quail response to our different management practices, and we have approximately 4,000 acres of ag fields, agricultural lands throughout our WMA system that are managed through farming contracts, and some of those contracts define that fallow field edges have to be kept up, biannual fall disking on those edge buffers, maintain early successional habitat to the adjacent woodlands, and leaving a percentage of the unharvested crops adjacent to the field borders. We have longleaf and shortleaf pine restoration projects that are, when feasible, we conduct those on our WMAs. Of course, we have prescribed burns going on to restore grassland communities. And a few years ago, we partnered with the U.S. Forest Service, and this is getting down closer to you guys. We established the Boggy Hollow Wildlife Management Area on part of the Conecuh National Forest in 2017 as a quail and small game area. And the management efforts there are more quail-focused and include the timber thinning, the frequent prescribed fire, increased acreage of the wildlife openings, and a reduction in the burn unit size. And we're continuing to work with those guys to establish a long-term quail management plan there and implement all those practices even a little more. And then we also have an ongoing partnership with the Forest Service and Quail Forever up on Chocolaca Wildlife Management Area in the Talladega National Forest. And we're improving around 3,000 acres of habitat there, and plans there include everything I mentioned for Boggy Hollow, along with longleaf pine restocking and at a low density, and establishing those small burn units and creating more fields and openings and population monitoring there.
A quick question before we wrap. Have you seen success? Have you seen success with those management?
Through our monitoring in the fall and spring, those populations are showing a response. It's not a real great response now, but it's positive and it's better than negative. So we're going to continue working on that and hopefully get those quail numbers up.
Do you see a time in the next decade that people will be able to go harvest bobwhite quail on public land in Alabama?
Yes. They can actually do it now.
Yeah, but I guess not legally, but have a good chance at it.
Yeah. I mean, we've got hunters now that you know, they're hard at it. They're old school, and they go out and they find quail.
I need to find their dogs and get one off that litter. I tell you what, Stephen, we're going to do this again next week on the show. I appreciate you being on and coming back on with us coming up next week.
I can do it.
All right.
Look forward to it.
All right, Stephen Mitchell, Upland Bird Coordinator for the state of Alabama, our guest man. What a bunch to talk about there, and we're going to do it again next week, and we're going to bring in some more resources on how you can do this on your land. It's coming up on next week's FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors.